This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
It's 5 o'clock. Rock Chalk Sports Talk, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. We have a 33% edition of RCST, a one-hour edition of Rock Chalk Sports Talk. So no time to waste as we welcome on our first guest of the afternoon. It's David Leske of Baseball Prospectus. Kansas City Royals win, take 2 of 3. Salvador Perez with a grand slam in the eighth inning. Did you see that one coming, David?
You know, I saw something coming. When you walk three guys to start an inning, you know something bad's going to happen. But I can't say that I actually thought there would be a grand slam, but I was not disappointed. He gave more than 33% effort on that. I'll give you that. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, that's safe to say. And now you take 2 of 3, one game under 500 right now. It's so weird. We talked just last week, and from a record standpoint, from a standing standpoint, not a ton has changed, but it just seems like there is momentum being built in the right direction. Do you feel the same way?
Oh yeah, I mean they're what 8-9-2 in their last 11. You know, they're winning games in different ways. Some games they're pitching well. Some games they're hitting a ton. Some games they're coming back. Yeah, they're doing basically everything you want to do. And I think that they're looking like a team that you don't think is a guaranteed loss every night, which is what we saw in April. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of momentum. I think that this team has kind of figured out their identity a little bit. And you know, they're playing really well right now. You always look at a team. They're never as good as they are when they're really hot. They're never as bad as they are when they're really cold, unless you're like the 2005 Royals. They're absolutely as bad as they are when they were cold. But they're kind of finding their identity, and they're probably somewhere in between a 7-16 team and a 9-2 team. But you know, with the way the American League sets up, and with the way the American League Central has set up, they don't have to be a lot better than mediocre. And lately they have been a lot better. So hopefully they can ride it a little bit longer before they ultimately hit a lull, because they will. Every team does, and you know, maybe they'll have been able to get into a playoff position by then.
I guess my biggest question is, and I've asked you this probably 3 or 4 times, but it's relevant because the goalposts kind of keep changing here with what this team needs to do to get to the postseason, to win the division. Like, if we're still looking at a magical number around 88 to 90 wins, it still seems like what they've done over the past month, which is be one of the best teams in the American League, they have to continue to do that if they want to get to that number and be in a solid position to make the postseason, right?
Yeah, so they're 28-20 since May 1st, and I haven't done the math, but I did it a couple of days ago. And if they continue on their pace since May 1st, the rest of the season, that'll get them to 86, 87 wins. I think 86 might actually end up being enough, given how just awful everybody is. I'm not sure it's enough for the first wild card, so then you ask another question of, do you go for it to play a one game winner, loser goes home road game? You know, I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe that's not the best use of your assets. But they're kind of trending toward that. But again, what they since May 1st, they have not hit a cold stretch yet. Although I guess maybe they have in that 28-20. But you know, I think that they need to do even better than they have done if they want to make more than just be the road team in a one game loser goes home playoff, basically. So there's a lot of work left to do, and that's what happens when you go 7-16 in a month. You have to do more than other teams might have to do, because you dug yourself a bigger hole than they dug themselves.
We're talking to David Leske of Baseball Prospectus Kansas City here on Rock Chalk Sports Talk, new FM 101.7, 1320 KLWN. So the win moves the Royals to 35-36, 3 games out of first. And of course, just our luck, like the Royals start getting hot, winners of, 9 of their last 11 now, and the Indians are playing like the best team in baseball, like the team we expected them to last year. So the fact that all year long we're talking about, well, the Royals aren't out of it because nobody's running away with the AL Central. Not saying the Indians are running away with it, but they're starting to play like we expected them to. it feels like that almost ramps up the intensity and the urgency of the Royals to continue to play good baseball, because all it's going to take is one bad week, and all of a sudden the Indians could start running away with it.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't know, I think it was 2013. Remember when the Royals were reeling win after win after win, but so were the Tigers. And so they won like 17 of 21 and gained half a game or something like that. Crazy. That's kind of what this is feeling like right now. And, you know, even last night, the Royals lost and the Indians lost. So they had a chance to gain a game if they had been able to beat Chris Sale. But, you know, it's just bad timing on the loss even. And so, yeah, it's frustrating. And you're right. There is extra urgency because the Indians are good enough that they may not go into a lull. Their lull might be they lose 4 of 7. And that's a lull, yes, but it's not crazy. And whereas the Royals' lull, we've seen what they look like. They lose 6 of 7 or 7 of 7 in those. And they can't afford that if they want to compete in the division. I think the wild card is, if you're looking at a playoff spot, I think the wild card is what you have to look at, because I just think the Indians are a better team. But they are close enough that it wouldn't be the craziest thing in the world if they were able to overcome a three-game deficit and win the Central. I'm not predicting it, but, you know, it's possible.
So what do you think is the most likeliest of scenarios between now and the trade deadline? Like, do the Royals just have to maintain what they're doing? Do they have to continue looking like one of the best teams in the AL? I mean, what's the margin of error between now and when they'll ultimately have to make a decision on what they're going to do with the rest of the season?
Well, I mean, I think that where they've gotten to at this point indicates that they're probably not going to sell. That obviously could change if they win like 4 games between now and the deadline. But if they continue to even play 500 baseball, which is less than they've done over the last 2 months almost, I don't see how Dayton Moore looks at that team and says, okay, we're a game under 500, whatever it is, 4 games out of first place, 2 games out of the wild card. Yeah, we're going to sell. I just don't see that in his DNA. And so I think that we've gotten to a point where this is probably the team for the rest of the season. There was an article on John Heyman's site, FanRag Sports, which is a weird name for John Heyman's site to be. But they mentioned that there was a quote from a Royals official saying, if we keep playing like this, we won't be selling, we'll be adding. And so that's something to think about, too. At this point, are they looking to become buyers, maybe? Because, you know, maybe they're in a position where they think, okay, we need a right-handed reliever. We need a guy to plug in at DH, you know, something like that. And there's a lot of possibilities between now and the deadline. And I think that selling is probably the least likely at this point, because they're kind of in a position where they're unlikely, unless they go crazy bad, like I said, they're unlikely to be that far out of the race come the deadline.
Man, that seems like a mistake.
I agree.
I know you and I have talked extensively about it, and I agree with everything you said. I agree that it is part of Dayton Moore's DNA, and it's kind of what we should come to expect at this point, that he's going to continue to place his trust on the guys who brought a World Series back to Kansas City. I just think that 2013, 2014 was a time when you could make decisions with your gut. You could make decisions based off emotion. 2017 is not the time to do it. And this is an organization that's been to the mountaintop, man. They won it all. They've been to the pinnacle. And anything that's short of that isn't going to necessarily add up. And it's hard for me to imagine them winning the World Series again, but maybe I'm being too pessimistic and looking way too far down the line. But it just doesn't seem like the logical decision at this point, unless they are like running away with the Central, unless they're in first place by 3 or 4 games. Like, to be a team that's around 500 at the trade deadline and deciding you want to stand pat, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
No, I agree with you. I think that if they're going to stand pat, like you said, they've got to be 8 games over 500.
Right. You know, exactly. Yeah.
They can't be 2 games under, 2 games over. They've got to be a team that you look at and you go, okay, that can be a playoff team. And you're right. Winning the World Series has changed the expectations, because had they not gone to the playoffs in 2014 or won the World Series in 2015, I think that we'd be going, well, they could play a wild card game, guys. I mean, we gotta stick. If they can play 1 game in the playoffs, that would be great. Well, 1 game in the playoffs doesn't mean as much anymore, because as fans, I mean, they've played 31 games in the playoffs. You know, they've almost won 2 World Series since then. So it's a little bit different. And it's, that there's a it's a heart versus head discussion. Do they do the smart thing and reload for 2019, 2020, 2021, or do they try to pull out some magic like they did in 2014 and even a little bit in 2013, you know, competing for a playoff spot deep into September? I don't know. Personally, I'm with you. If I'm running the organization, they better be really good by the deadline for me to not sell. Basically, they have to be good enough for me to add, for me to not sell. You know, yeah, if they're sitting there at 500 or so.
Like, go all in either way, right? Commit to whatever you're going to do.
Right, and that's kind of the issue that we have with the offseason, too. I mean, they committed to both. They committed to both rebuilding and selling, and that's not enough because they were able to trade two of their pending free agents for guys who can help them this season and beyond. And look, I really loved the Dyson for Nate Karns deal. As much as I love Jerod Dyson, I like Nate Karns as a pitcher an awful lot. And I don't have a problem with that deal, but we see what that's done. I mean, Nate Karns is on the disabled list, and there's really no end in sight. And Jorge Soler is doing very well for Omaha. So, you know, that plan has already backfired a little bit. And I think that standing pat would kind of be more of the same thing, and you're just kind of serving both sides by doing that. I just think if you're going to do it, like you said, go all in one way or another.
He's David Leske, Baseball Prospectus, Kansas City, New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. I think that fans would be really upset if they were around 500 and decided to sell, but that's what fans do, and especially this fan base. I mean, there are some emotional ties for what they were able to accomplish a couple years ago, and I get it, and it's what makes them great. But I think Dayton Moore is in a position where it's almost like he is a parent disciplining his child, knowing that it's better in the long run. Like, I know you're not going to like eating your vegetables now. I know you don't like taking out the trash and doing yard work right now, but it's going to be better for you in the long run. I feel like that's the move that Dayton Moore has to make, which is, I know you don't want to see these guys go. I know you don't want to see Hosmer and Moose and Kane go. But I promise you, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, you're going to realize how good of a decision it was, because you're not back at the bottom of the standings as a laughingstock trying to build this organization back up from nothing. Like, it's going to help a lot.
Beat the heat at Briggs and Lawrence.
What do we got going on there? It's going to help a lot if you've got a little bit of help coming your way right now.
Well, I mean, think back to 2010 and 2012. People did not like trading Zach Greinke. People did not like trading Will Myers, Mike Montgomery. I was in that camp. I did not like that trade. What happened? I mean, those two trades helped to shape the World Series champions. And I'm not saying that means Dayton Moore gets all the benefit of the doubt, that he can do no wrong, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, we have a recent history where making somewhat unpopular trades worked out for the best. So I'm with you. I think that, and I don't know that I'd call trading equivalent to eating vegetables, but maybe it's because I like broccoli.
But you didn't when you were five, David. Don't lie.
That's actually not true. I loved broccoli because I thought they looked like trees, and I thought that was cool.
I was the same way with black olives. I'd put them on my fingers and eat them off.
Yeah, that was some good stuff. Anyway, so we ate our vegetables. We're bad examples, but I think you're right. I think that they probably need to do the unpopular thing, and I think it's very likely that they won't. And, you know, that's not the worst thing in the world, because it'll give the fans an extra 2 months with these guys. It'll give Mike Moustakas an opportunity to break the single-season home run record, which I think he'll do. It'll give Eric Hosmer 2 more months to rack up some numbers as a Royal. You know, all this stuff. And so it's not awful. Maybe it gives Jason Vargas a chance to finish top five in the Cy Young voting as a Royal. But it ultimately, for the future, probably the wrong decision.
He's David Leske. You can check out all of his work at Baseball Prospectus Kansas City. That's bpkansascity.com on Twitter at dbleske. Appreciate the time, man.
Of course. Thanks, Nick.
All righty. That's David Leske. I'm Nick Schwert, Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. It seems like we're starting to get some answers as to exactly what went down between Jeremy Maclin and Kansas City. We'll try to get to the bottom of it next. Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. The NBA draft a little over 24 hours away, and we still have no idea where Josh Jackson's going to go. With Derek Johnson, I'm Nick Schwert. I think it could go as high as 3. I think it could fall as low as 4. So maybe we, I guess we do have a little bit more of an idea as to where he's going to go. But there are just so many names who are tossed around in that three spot. It could be Jason Tatum. It could be De'Aaron Fox. And I guess the reason why I say we don't have any idea is because it seems like we know exactly who the first two teams are going to take, right? The Celtics or the 76ers are going to take Markelle Fultz. The Lakers are going to take Lonzo Ball. After that is where things kind of open up a bit. We didn't talk about this at all earlier in the week, but did you see what Josh Jackson tweeted? It was shortly after the Celtics and the 76ers had made that trade, and he did delete it afterwards, but this is at 10:30 on, I think, Saturday night, and Jackson tweeted, LOL, anybody with the smallest bit of talent can look good and lose. Cry laughing emoji. It's not that hard.
I wonder who that's about.
Well, some would say it is about the consensus number one overall pick in Markelle Fultz, who won, what, 9 games at Washington in his only year at college. I don't get what does he have against Markelle Fultz? Or does he just have...
I don't think he has something against Fultz. I just think he's had it with people saying that Fultz is better than you.
Do you think the lack of winning in college should play a factor into a player's draft stock?
Well, it should go down on your... Because for every prospect, you have pros, cons. It's just his pros outweigh that. I think what would scare you more is the fact that, like with Ben Simmons, it was still a knock against him. But with Markelle Fultz, this is, like, to another level of knock. They won 9 games. With LSU, even though they weren't even an NCAA tournament team, they were at least, like, an average team in the SEC. And maybe that's because Washington's team was really that bad.
Okay, but what if Markelle Fultz would have went to Kansas? He would have won a lot of games.
Yeah.
All of a sudden.
But how good would he have looked? We don't know.
I mean, the numbers wouldn't have been as gaudy as they were at Washington, but the efficiency probably would have been better.
I would still take...
Same way where Josh Jackson could have put up huge numbers at Washington, but the efficiency wouldn't have been as high.
Right. And I think they were both in perfect situations, though, because Josh Jackson is more of a guy who he can feed off of help from other teammates. He's such a good passer, not that Markelle Fultz isn't. And I just think that kind of goes up with who Josh Jackson is. He is a guy who likes to win. Not that, again, Markelle Fultz doesn't, but it seems like it benefited them both pretty well, and it seems like it fit who they are pretty well. I would probably take Markelle Fultz number one overall.
Well, a lot of people have Fultz going number one and Lonzo Ball going number two, and some people are split on what Boston's going to do at number three. They could take Josh Jackson. They could take Jason Tatum. They could trade the pick. They could trade it for a star player like Paul George or Jimmy Butler. We don't really know what they're going to do there, but Josh Jackson never worked out for the Celtics. And you can say it's not a big deal and that they've got plenty of tape on him and they're not going to make their decision based off something so minor like that. But it absolutely plays into the equation. Josh Jackson doing the rounds at ESPN with several of the other top prospects today. And he was asked about the whole situation of whether he worked out for Boston or not.
Your name has been discussed with multiple teams, but most specifically with Boston. Have you worked out for the Celtics?
I have not worked out for the Celtics.
Okay, why not?
Well, they did a little bit of moving around with their pick. Mm-hmm. I felt like they, you know, made it pretty clear who they were going to draft with the number one pick. So I didn't really feel like it was worth either of our times for me to work out with them. But then after they, you know, did the flip and went to number three, by then it was too late.
Okay. So it was a scheduling thing lately here.
And I feel bad for Jackson because it's not like he's sitting there on the phone with Danny Ainge saying, I'm not going to come work out for you. Furthermore, he's not even the one making the decision. Josh Jackson isn't even telling his agent, I'm not working out for them unless they guarantee me they're going to stay at number three. It's his agent is pulling all of these strings, and then he's the one who has to go in front of the cameras, in front of the microphones, and answer for it. And I don't think it's a terribly bad look. I know people are going to point to that and say, I don't like this kid's attitude. You know, he doesn't want to work out for this team because he's not guaranteed certain things. Like, you're not guaranteed it. You can already hear those takes coming, and it's not Jackson's fault. His agent's telling him, hey, this is what's best for you. Don't work out for them. It's a waste of our time for you to do that. And then he's got to go and do these interviews and answer, well, why didn't you work out for them? That's a little bit unorthodox. Now, ESPN reported yesterday that Jackson did refuse to work out for the Celtics unless they assured him that they would hang on to the number three pick and that he was the top player on their board. So apparently Boston wasn't willing to assure him of that. Just based off everything that's happening, it wouldn't shock me at all if Boston just passed on Josh Jackson. Not necessarily because of one reason or the other, but you add everything together, and it just doesn't seem like a lock for it to happen.
It doesn't, but I would also say, like, Boston doesn't seem like a franchise to where they're going to cower down to your demands. So I think if you have a case where you're Boston, where Jason Tatum and Josh Jackson are neck and neck for you, like one is just an inch better than the other, or they're the same, then I could see this affecting that. But I don't see Boston being a place to where if they have Josh Jackson clearly graded above Jason Tatum, I don't think they'd pass on him. I don't think this would change that, because then you get in a situation of you go down the line, and in future years, if you have the best prospect in the draft and you have the number one pick, and they say, you know what, well, in years past, if a player doesn't want to go there, they just don't have to work out there. Then all of a sudden, you put yourself in a really tough situation.
No, and I think that Danny Ainge is one of the best GMs in basketball. You're going to pick the best player that you want. You're going to pick the guy that you think comes in and helps your team the best. And if that happens to be Josh Jackson, then you're going to pick him whether he worked out for you or whether he didn't. Now, Jackson, in that same interview, and the natural next question is, well, I mean, does that make you a little uneasy? Does that make you uncomfortable about what's going to happen on Thursday night?
Do you have concern at all that that will affect you come Thursday night?
It could. It may or may not, but you know, like I said before, I'm just happy to be here today, and, you know, wherever I end up Thursday, I'll be happy.
So it sounds like a guy who doesn't really care where he goes. Like, he's not dead set the way that Lonzo Ball's dead set on playing for the Lakers. He'd be fine playing for the Lakers. He'd be fine playing for the Celtics. He'd be fine going number four to the Suns. He's going to get playing time in any of those spots, so it doesn't really seem like it's going to affect him one way or the other. Now, the Bulls are maybe, maybe not, shopping Jimmy Butler. Jimmy Butler hasn't come out and said that he doesn't want to play in Chicago. He hasn't come out and asked for a trade. He hasn't came out and said
actually said the opposite.
Yeah, he hasn't. He said he wanted to stay in Chicago yesterday, as if we're to believe the reports. But for some reason, he's still a name that's being thrown out there as a really, really premier player in the league. It's kind of odd to hear this happening. Well, now ESPN reports that the Bulls are interested in Josh Jackson. And that would make perfect sense because the Celtics have the number three pick. They're looking for a big-time player. They trade the number three pick and any number of assets that they want over to Chicago. Chicago gets their guy in Josh Jackson. Boston gets their guy in Jimmy Butler.
I could get down with that, Josh Jackson to Chicago. I think the only franchises you wouldn't want to see him as a KU fan who's going to root for this kid in the NBA, Sacramento and maybe the Knicks.
No, you don't want him going into dysfunctional organizations. You probably throw the Lakers into that mix as well. They haven't necessarily been the poster child for how to run an organization over the past decade. Yeah, the Knicks, not where you want to be. Sacramento is where prospects' dreams go to die. That's the last place you want to see him. They're at number five. I guess it could happen.
They have 5 and 10. They could move up.
Man, if you hear Jason Tatum selected third, and then you get to number four with Phoenix, they wouldn't take a point guard, you wouldn't think. So it would almost, they'd almost have to take Josh Jackson at four. I don't think he's going to slip past four. I also don't think he's going number two to L.A. I think he's going three or four. That's his window. It's a pretty tight one. And I think whichever one of those places he ends up going, there's a good chance he's going to end up thriving. I'm Nick Schwert. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. All right, Jesse, the NBA draft coming up tomorrow night. Josh Jackson seems to be a lock for the top three or four picks. I don't know how much time you've spent kind of studying this, but if you're an NBA GM, where are you selecting Josh Jackson?
Well, luckily I'm not. I mean, that's the number one thing we want to talk about with this. But it's just crazy to me how it seems like the ebbs and flows of the stock and how quickly it can change for guys in the course of not only days but like minutes. You know, we were talking last week and you think Josh Jackson, okay, maybe he's at least the number two pick and he could be going number one. Maybe the Celtics like him and he's, you know, working out for the Lakers twice and all this stuff. And then you know, it's crazy. The trade happens, and then all of a sudden, you know, there's some momentum that goes in a negative direction, and it's just crazy to me how quickly this thing can turn. But, you know, it looks to me third or fourth, exactly like you said. That seems about right. And, again, a lot of this might just depend on team need. And you always hear about draft the best available player, all that stuff. You hear a lot about that in the NFL and especially Major League Baseball. But the NBA, it's a little bit different because when you get these rookies in, a lot of them can play right away. You know, you can fill an immediate need, and you don't have to wait, you know, 6 years for MLB or a couple years for the NFL. So, yeah, again, third or fourth seems like the most likely scenario for Josh Jackson. And I'll have a story coming out here later today about it, too, kind of the success that Bill Self has had in getting first-round picks at Kansas and how he compares to other schools. But to kind of ruin the surprise, he's been pretty good. And Kentucky, as you'd expect, is at the top of that list. But KU's not far behind, and really second to no one on that list besides maybe Duke. You can consider them a little bit better, but as far as North Carolina goes and some of those other schools, KU's right up there with them.
Well, let's talk about the last guy to go number one for KU, Andrew Wiggins, a couple of years ago. We've already seen what Andrew Wiggins is capable of in the league. We don't know what Jackson's going to look like, but when it's all said and done, who do you think will have the more successful NBA career, Jackson or Wiggins?
Man, that's a tough one. And the funny part about that, too, it's just interesting because they compare to each other. You know, that's what's so crazy is that Kansas has basically gotten these two players and one has gotten comp to the other so many times. I mean, I guess I would take Wiggins just because he's already
seems
started
pretty confident
to,
there.
It seems like he started to shore up some of his weaknesses, and obviously the jump shot that he had was a big question mark going to the pros, kind of like it with Josh Jackson. And, you know, him shoring that up makes you feel a lot better about his future and his offensive game, all those sorts of things. And, you know, he's a guy that also sometimes he might be the Eric Hosmer of the NBA, where advanced stats don't love him as much as maybe the eye test and some of the raw point per game totals. But, you know, still the fact that he's addressed some of the flaws that he had coming out, even as the number one pick, I think I'd go with Wiggins. But I think part of what makes Josh Jackson such an enticing prospect is that you can dream on him. I mean, you can look at him and say, look, he's got a great motor. He's got great athleticism. He can guard all these positions. He can play different positions. And you might not have seen the best of Josh Jackson yet. And kind of like Andrew Wiggins, you know, you look at him and you say, I don't think I see a finished product yet. So both those guys are similar in that way. But I guess I'll take Wiggins just for the simple fact of, you know, 3 years in, he has improved some of those things you weren't so sure about with him. Whereas Josh Jackson, he's still kind of in that spot where teams are going to draft him based on potential, but that potential is not quite at a point yet where you can say it's a sure thing.
Yeah, I'm with you. I just think when you look at Jackson, and Wiggins does have the benefit of knowing that he can succeed and play at a pretty high level in the NBA, and we don't know at all how Jackson's going to fit into the next level. But I just have a hard time seeing him not find a way onto the court consistently. Like, I don't know if he's going to score consistently. I don't know if he's going to be as efficient of a playmaker as he was in college. But because of the diversity that you kind of just spoke to, it's hard for me to imagine a scenario where that guy's not helping a team in some form or fashion, regardless of where he goes.
Yeah, and where he's going to get drafted, he's going to get opportunity. You absolutely know that. And that's kind of the big difference between a guy in his scenario and some of those guys that go undrafted or, you know, late in the second round, where teams just aren't as invested in them. And, you know, you've even seen with like a Thomas Robinson, who hasn't had the most successful pro career. The thing about him is that, you know, you get taken fifth overall in the draft, teams are going to keep giving you shots. I mean, teams are going to keep believing that you know, what led you being a top five overall pick is going to show itself through. So that's really where Jackson gets a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, is that once he does become a top five pick, which everybody expects at this point, that even if things go not so well early on, or even if it's not a perfect fit with his team, or even if he needs to find a new surroundings, teams are going to continue to give him chances just because of all those things that we're talking about right now with him in his future. But again, you know, it seems like we've gone on this over this on and on and on. And I've been on like the Lakers podcast about him and talked about him, but it seems like we know pretty definitively what his strengths and weaknesses are. I mean, the two question marks you're going to talk about with his game are, you know, the jump shooting and the range outside and whether that's going to be an issue at the next level or not. And then, again, just kind of the competitiveness slash maybe too much competitiveness at times, and maybe getting his own way, as you saw in the Oregon game where he picked up some silly fouls and kind of took himself out of that game. So those are kind of the weaknesses, and then all the strengths we talked about, you know, transition and being able to play different positions and guard different positions and athleticism that you need at the next level and all those sorts of things. They all add up to a player that you would consider to be a top five pick in this draft, but
we can't underrate the value of just team fit, coaching, all those sorts of things that play into it, because he can land in a good situation, be a star right away, and he can land in a bad situation. It could slow him up quite a bit. So, again, we're kind of just in the back seat here watching as things go, but Josh Jackson, a whole lot of potential scenarios out there. But if nothing else, you're going to see a top five pick from him. I think that much is certain.
We're talking to Jesse Newell of the Kansas City Star here on Rock Chalk Sports Talk, New FM 101.7, 1320 KLWN. What about Frank Mason? Do you think he's going to hear his name called tomorrow?
I think so. You know, I wouldn't have said so a couple months ago. I remember, you know, talking on a bunch of podcasts and radio shows just saying that he was likely going to be a guy that had to prove himself because of his size, and he'd probably be undrafted. But, some team would give him a shot because he was going to be National Player of the Year, one of the top players in the Big 12, and when that sort of thing happens, you get a look. You get someone to take a chance on you. But this is a little bit different. You've seen some of the guys, some of the smaller guards in the NBA start to succeed. And I think that really helps Frank Mason. I think he's coming out at a really good time. And so, you've seen most mock drafts. He's somewhere usually in the 40 to 50 range, midway through the second round. And, just the fact that guys have and can succeed playing at the size that he is with the wingspan that he has, that's positive for him. Looking at him, it's kind of the same way with Josh Jackson. I feel like after seeing him for 4 years at Kansas, we pretty much know the strengths and weaknesses of his game. I mean, the strengths is he's turned himself into a great outside shooter. He's great in pick-and-roll scenarios, and that's so much at the NBA level of what they do. That can really be something where if you go under a screen, he can shoot a three over the top of you. If you don't hedge it well, he can split that and try to get to an open teammate. He can pass well. He can shoot and make NBA three-pointers. He was on the All-Big 12 defensive team his junior year, so he can do that as well. And, again, the big question mark is just the size. And we've seen him at Kansas. The numbers from hoopmath.com would reflect it that he got better over time at finishing at the rim. But, shot blockers affected him, and he needed help from guys like Landon Lucas to shield guys off in the paint. And shot blockers did give him trouble when he went in there, and he did have, his fair share of shots not go in when he was able to drive and get to the rim. So, again, just all those things that happened, there's a reason that there aren't many – short point guards at the NBA level. It's just because guys get bigger and taller and more athletic, and it's even more difficult to get your shot up and in when you're that type of player. But Frank Mason has worked himself into a guy that, again, he's going to get probably drafted, and if he gets drafted, then teams are going to give him a longer look than if he was an undrafted free agent. So that's a positive for him, and knowing him, all he's going to want is a shot. So he'll get that shot in the NBA, and from where he started at, a low-level college recruit to where he is now, and potentially getting drafted and moving on to the next level, I think that's probably all he could have asked for.
Is there an ideal style of play at the next level that you think would fit his needs?
That's a really good question, and I'm probably the wrong person to ask for that just because I just don't pay as much attention to the NBA games as I do college, and I probably should, but, especially the course of the regular season, we get so bogged down with what's happening with KU and just sort of different stylistic things that happen there and trying to keep your ear to what's going on there.
Well,
you
not
don't
even
really
like
to watch too much pro basketball.
Not even like team specific, but I mean, like, if you're building the perfect offense to have Frank Mason be the point guard, like, what would that look like in your eyes?
Well, again, for Kansas, if you look last year, a lot of what their offense did, I mean, Bill Self basically created a new offense for Frank Mason and Josh Jackson, if you look at it. I mean, a lot of those high ball screens, pick and roll actions, and then the weave action, their four game that they did out top where you'd see the guys weave around. I mean, those were basically just saying, I'm going to play to Frank Mason and Josh Jackson's strengths. And so, like I said with Frank, the thing with his skill set that's so unique is that usually if you get in a high ball screen scenario, you can have a guy that can't shoot a three but can drive. And so, okay, you play a ball screen a certain way and you can kind of funnel him out and make him prove that he can shoot over the top of you. Or if he's a shooter, okay, you go over the ball screen, make sure that he drives, but he's not a great driver, he's not a good passer, so you really can play it that way. What made him so dangerous, I remember writing this blog after the Indiana game, even the first game of the season, where KU late in that game just continued running the same play over and over, just a high ball screen for Frank Mason, and he just continued to not only make plays and score and have passes, but he continued to make the right decisions in those plays and make good reads, which is so much of what basketball is that not only can he shoot threes over the top, not only can he get to the lane and split a double team and find an open guy, but he can read the defender and say, okay, I can see that big man's backing off of me. I've got a wide open three. Or I can see that the big man is hedging really hard, so maybe there's another open player somewhere else. But where he's really good is that he, on the fly, kind of has, I don't know if you don't call it basketball IQ or just good instincts, but he has the skill set to be able to beat you in all those different ways. And then he also has the smarts and the instincts and the intangibles to beat you all in all those specific ways. And we know now, I mean, not only the college game, the NBA game has gone so much to that pick and roll and those sorts of actions that, you know, he can thrive in a system like that. Again, the big question is, how you hear this in baseball all the time, you know, and the Aaron Judge of the world start hitting home runs and the pitchers adjust to them, so how are you going to adjust back? I mean, it's surely the NBA is going to adjust to what Frank Mason can do and maybe force him to make shots at the rim before they start helping off quite a bit on him as college teams did. I guess the adjustment there is going to be the big key for Frank Mason. Can he succeed with like he did in college and then adjust to how our defense is going to play him at the next level, because it is going to be tougher to get his shots to go down inside.
He's Jesse Newell. You can check out his work in the Kansas City Star and at KUHoops.com. Appreciate the time as always, man.
Hey, no problem, Nick.